Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Brian's back.
Yeah.
Well, you see, disappointingly, I've put on the description that the final whistle for Rob Hicks, but I've read the story now, and he's still going to be doing it part-time. Rob Hicks is here, ladies and gentlemen.
Oh, yeah.
Part-time. Not quite sure what that means yet. How? Well, it means I've got to pass fitness test in December. And if I pass that, I might be getting able to do the odd game.
The thing about passing the fitness test is now you have technically retired, because that's what it...
Yeah.
You can now go and eat all the things you've denied yourself. By the time December comes around, you won't pass the fitness test.
That's the theory. I've already enlisted the help of one of our young, extremely fit, part-time refs to get me through that fitness test.
So you ended in Perpignan?
Yes. Yes, I thought I'd ended in Toulouse, but then ended up in Perpignan as well.
What was it like? I mean,
the occasion was fantastic. International Rugby League is the most important part of the game, in my opinion. It's the one bit that gets traction from the Beeb and a national broadcaster that's free to air. It brings all parts of the game together. I think logistically it had been an extremely difficult challenge, put together very last minute. I think there was a lot of people at the RFL had done a lot of hard work behind the scenes. I know the French Federation too, they'd been busy. There was a good crowd, there was a good atmosphere.
Two competitive games.
The women's game was excellent. I think people don't understand the challenge that had gone on to get to there that day. Everyone had been up to fly out of Manchester early hours of the morning into Perpignan. I would expect the women had probably never done that before. Into a game, straight off the bus, get something to eat, get changed, start playing a game of rugby league. And I think that probably showed, if you were honest, in the first 10, 15 minutes. They didn't complete very high, but they then, I think their class told in the second half. When they brought,
Page turn.
15 and 16 turned the game, didn't they? England got on the front foot when the two big forwards changed hands and they really dominated the ruck area at that point. I'll tell you the names.
I think the other thing is that's looking at it from an England perspective, which is fine, but I just thought the French women, who haven't really had a domestic competition for 18 months, and as you were saying, some of whom were very early in their development, they put up a terrific fight for the first 25 minutes. The end of sets weren't great, but the commitment...
It bodes well for next year, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
The acid test is always going to be Australia and New Zealand in the women's game. And I think everybody knows that that's going to be difficult. But the reality is, we are where we are and we can only play the teams we play. And from England's perspective, I think they can be better than they were and they won comfortably. From a French perspective, it gives them something to build on. And the profile of the TV, I think that's the thing for me.
Yeah.
My son plays in a boys team under 10s, which has four or five girls playing in it. The ability for those girls to watch women on the BBC and think that could be me, I just don't think you can underestimate the power of that.
You know, we've awarded the 2020 Golden Boot to the fellow from the Netherlands.
We have, yeah. Not officially.
Not officially. That means either someone from this game between England and France and the Wales-Ireland game the other week gets the women's Golden Boot.
I think, without breaking any exclusives, there is no Golden Boot award this year.
It's disappointing, isn't it?
There's going to be a long list of players for 2022, including those who've performed brilliantly in 2021. But no, the women's and wheelchair groups didn't want it awarded.
I thought the French fullback, by the way, was one of the best players I'd seen on the field for the first 40 minutes.
Syria, because her name was memorable.
Joran Schoenmaker's going to have to wait until being awarded his Golden Boot.
I'll just go on Wikipedia and edit it like they did when Bradford won the 30 Yorkshire Cup. Welcome, Robert, says Tim. Looking forward to hearing about your new job. Was it a difficult decision to go upstairs?
Go upstairs nearly every week. Well, nice. Was it a difficult decision? Yes and no. It was a difficult decision because I absolutely love refereeing and I loved being part of the full-time group. They are a brilliant bunch of people to work with. They're hardworking, they're dedicated, all the things you'd say, but boy did we have some fun and laughs, and boy did we have some good memories of games and trips. It's a wrench to leave that. Was it a difficult decision? No, because it was a great opportunity to finally move into an area that I think I can add some value to, that I've been involved in on a part-time basis for 10 years, but ultimately it's a chance to work in administration of the sport I love, to try and make a difference off the field. And the reality is, I was 40 this year, we've got two exceptionally talented young referees who've done the last few major finals between them. They're far fitter than me, they're far better than me, and competing with them this year was difficult. And then there are other people around who will compete as well. So realistically, I'd have loved to have finished on a World Cup. That's being honest. I'd always wanted to referee a World Cup in my home country. But I could have gone another 12 months, not performed very well and not refereed at that World Cup. And this opportunity then wouldn't have been there. And that boat would have sailed. And then I'd have been back in private practice somewhere with regrets. And I can say now I haven't got any regrets for anything I've done.
In terms of what you'll miss the most, we don't understand what it means to be a professional referee. We think that you probably train twice a week and sit in a classroom, but how much of a difference has that made going full time, and what would an average week for you consist of?
I think proof's in the pudding, if I'm honest, that the full time referees consistently deliver better performances than the part time referees, because they haven't got to worry about the hassle of a day job and what might have gone wrong in the week. If they're refereeing on a Thursday or a Friday night, if they choose to stay at home all day and watch Netflix and relax and have a sleep and get themselves absolutely mentally prepared for a game, they can. They also get the opportunity to watch as much rugby league as they can, to learn off different referees and to learn off different situations and understand what different players are on. So I suppose the obvious thing is fitness is much more easy as a full-time ref. And I think the answer to that, therefore, is when I went full-time, I had loads of time on my hands compared with when I was a part-time lawyer working 9 to 5 Monday to Friday and then training 3 times a week, going to a group meeting once a week and then officiating twice a week. So work-life balance isn't there as a part-time official. You have to be very dedicated to do that, in my opinion.
This is a great question from Dave, our resident Featherston fan. Dave, we're coming to Fev. Watch out. And obviously, with your legal background, you can choose how to answer this as you will. Ask Rob if refs have a mad Monday.
He's just come back from Perpignan. Why weren't we on last night?
We have a day out at some point. This year it'll be my stag do. Most of them are coming on my stag do. But we normally would have one day where we would go off and have a few drinks and
slag off all the players.
Slag off all the refs, probably.
But But scrums will be back next year, you'll miss them. All of those rests in play that you could have had.
Yeah, the game will slow down again. No, we've got some great rules for scrums, haven't we? That we've not tried yet, so we'll finally get to see some scrum players again.
So I think we will talk about your new role, but mainly what it encompasses and what you hope to achieve from it. But we have to look back over a fantastic refereeing career. Impossible, but what will be your highlights? I know you'd be asked this 100 times.
Yeah.
And it might not be the obvious game, that's the only thing.
I think the most memorable occasion I've ever been involved in was the Tonga-England game at the World Cup in 2017. It just is the first game I ever think of in terms of unbelievable, indescribable atmosphere and occasion. I said this, I think, when I last spoke to you, Phil, and the Australian communication system costs fortune. It literally is like talking me and you here. And throughout that tournament, there was never any issue with that communication system. But for the last 15 minutes of that game, you literally couldn't hear anybody on the system, and we were down to using signals at the end of the game because it was that loud, and the ground was moving, genuinely moving. It was unbelievable. And I know everybody speaks about it when they were there, but to have actually been involved in that game with all the drama that went with it is probably the most memorable.
I mean, that's the power, again, of International Rugby League, isn't it? Because your first memory of, no, is not a domestic Grand Final or a Challenge Cup Final. It's that international dimension.
Yeah.
Which you just
I'm a big believer in the international game. I think it's the lever that we have to use to underpin the sport. The reality is, the bread and butter is always going to be the Super League and the Championship, and deep down the foundations is built on the community game, but it is a pyramid. If you think about a tree, I know Nigel Wood used to use this phrase, but the fruit, the very juicy fruit, is always at the top of the tree, and it's how you get that fruit to its most ripe, and that's by building all those other areas up to the right levels.
So which game that you were in the middle for stands out, or which games? And then, of course, obviously, who was the worst player you wanted to deal with, who's the best?
Best game. Could,
and then, and rapport. Have you noticed over a period of time that there's less of it and that you perhaps got more enjoyment early in your career when you could?
I probably got more enjoyment towards the end of my career when I perhaps felt a little bit more comfortable in my own skin. And perhaps the back end of this year where I perhaps knew that the end was nigh and therefore was able to relax and not worry too much about what you were saying and when you were saying it. Communication is a difficult skill. It got harder for refs when we got mic'd up. Mm. Football refs are mic'd up, you don't hear what they say. And I know when you speak to them, they have a very different way of managing a game.
Would you change that? Without getting into too much about your new role, would you recommend that? Well,
it's not something for my new role to consider. I think there's an added bonus to hearing a referee in that you can understand why he's said things and why he's done things. I don't think I'd change it, though.
So you're gone, then. Best
game. Well, Leeds and Huddersfield is obviously a memorable game for the end in terms of Blake Solly flying around on his helicopter all around everywhere. Just so many great games. I don't think a game has to be the highest skill level game for it to have been a great game. The Northern Rail Cup final in 2010 between Widnes and Batley was a great game and a great occasion and memorable to me for many reasons. Partly it was my first major final. The 2010 Championship final between Halifax and Featherstone, which had, I think, everything, including a major stoppage for a period. So there's just so many. You always love your finals. Refereeing major finals is unbelievable. Challenge Cups are memorable. Challenge Cup finals are probably the highlights of my career in terms of I'm of an era when the Challenge Cup was what you went to as a child with your dad down Wembley Way, and so achieving a major final at Wembley is something I'll always treasure. Grand finals are a different kettle of fish, but are fantastic. Fantastic under lights at Old Trafford. Yeah, just too many games. Just too many games. Yeah,
what
grand
about
finals were on kicks.
Players you didn't mind dealing with? Because you can say this now.
Yeah, people will always tell you, that, like, Jake Connor's hard work and Kevin Sinfield was hard work and Danny Maguire. No, they're just good players, and therefore they are good at doing what they need to do to win games. I don't find any player hard work. I can tell you that there are players who were difficult to manage, but that's life. Mm. You know, anybody who works in an office and says that they get on with everyone and can manage everybody's a liar.
Or a family.
Yeah.
Dysfunctional unit.
Oh, definitely mine. So, no, I don't
you'll
really have any
you'll
players.
Miss that, though.
I'll miss
that game day experience.
Yeah, I'll miss the challenge of managing 34 highly charged men on a field in big games. You know, the Leeds-Wigan playoff game this year, it was emotionally draining, as are all big games. So, yeah, I miss that massively. That is the highlight of why you do it.
You enjoyed that one, didn't you, sat in the stands?
Loved it. Not as much as I enjoyed Jamaica
see,
and Scotland.
It's amazing, isn't it? Because I thought it was a really tough, intense game.
Well, this is the one everyone thought was rubbish.
And everybody told me afterwards.
It's playoff rugby.
Well, I don't think you need them. There are different games that are better for different reasons. Mm. Leeds and Wigan was one of the most intense defensive games of the season. Was it high on drama and high on skill and chances? No, but not everybody loves that in a game of rugby league.
Rugby league's rubbish, though, isn't it?
But we were talking about that just before, that I think the Jamaica-Scotland game this weekend was one of the most enjoyable games of what has been a tough season because of all the circumstances surrounding it. When you think that we started in virtually empty stadiums and we've gone through all this, were games going to be on, were they not going to be on, where were they going to be played? And you end up at Featherstone with probably 1,500 people there, seeing the most competitive game you could between two sides who were so evenly matched, with a great atmosphere, steel band being played, resulting down until the very last kick of the game. I don't think you want any more than that. And it won't go down in the annals of one of the great games in history, but it was a wonderful afternoon. Everything that's great about the sport.
I think that's right.
That's what you miss.
Yeah. I'll still get to do some of that. Hopefully.
I'm trying to think now of... You mentioned that atmosphere at Tonga and England. Players will always say they don't hear anything from the crowd. The South Stand at Headingley, they're always shouting forward. Does that ever have any influence on your decisions whatsoever?
Do you know, I don't think...
It's filmed.
My honest opinion of that is, the bigger the crowd, the less you notice it. Because it's just noise. So... Yeah, the South Stand probably shout loads. I can remember being on the line at Headingley. James Shaw was on the other line, and we were both on the field against Leeds six times in the first half. And the crowd was wild, but it didn't change anything that happened. But there's a bloke at Wakefield who walks up and down that main stand, and you can hear
it's
him.
Not me.
You
not
can
not
hear
me.
Him throughout the game. Throughout the game. I don't know. He must walk up and down the stand, honestly. And he gets really personal. So you hear individual people, but you don't hear a big noise. So if all the crowd's up, it's just noise. But if it's one individual, and you know, and that's no criticism of the Wakefield crowd. It's the individual at Wakefield has an ability to come in on his own and get you, rather than everybody who's screaming and bawling at you from behind that stamp.
As Phil will know, there is a line for about five people who sit in front of the press benches at Bellevue, the Mobile Rocket, who probably should, at least Radio Leeds should probably pay them, because they're on there more than their commentators half the time. I bet they must be related. Carson asks, does the legal background help on the field?
It can help and it can hinder, is the short answer again. You can become too black and white as a lawyer, and that was a challenge I faced early in my career in Super League, that you took things too literally and everything had to have a defined answer, and deep down the game's better played in the grey.
Because it's not only is it interpretation, but it's actually dealing with people. And sometimes they're going to see a situation in black that is actually white. And it's how you convince them that grey is the ability for us to then play on for the next 10 minutes.
The game should be played in the grey. There shouldn't be a 2 plus 2 equals 4, A, B, C. You know, the game can become too stereotyped on that kind of
thing. So how much of a problem then is there with video analysis? Because in the early days that you were referenced, early days, sounds like you're 150 years old, there wasn't this scrutiny of seeing every incident from every angle, replayed, commented on by people in boxes, analysed on screen. How much harder does that make it? Because does it inhibit you to make a decision because you know it's going to be analysed? And
I think it actually gives you the confidence to go out and do it, because you may well prove yourself right. I used to like when we did the RFL referees Twitter account for a period. You used to play, he was miles offside, and you used to just pause the video and show they were onside and put the clip on there. People used to think you were arrogant for doing that, but no, just proving a point, you know, that he was onside. And moving parts, things like, the game is played in moving parts, so nothing is ever, there's always a reason why someone gets something wrong. We do get things wrong. It's natural to get things wrong. Players make mistakes in games, referees make mistakes in games, coaches do. So video analysis is very important to get better, but not necessarily was it right, was it wrong, but why was it wrong?
So we shouldn't go down the road of VAR, which is killing football, making it too clinical, analytical?
Yeah, I don't know whether it is. I don't know whether it is, really. I think the video ref's been an added bonus for our sport for a long period. I think we've got better at use of it over the last few years. We have blips, and again, video refs make mistakes, which perhaps is less understandable. But I think we do all right with what we've got as a video ref. I would have it every game.
Do you prefer the BBC style where we can hear the video referee making their deliberations? I guess like they do on the cricket, or Sky, where we just hear Tez and Phil.
I like the BBC version. You control the narrative.
Mm. And then we understand why the decision is...
You might not agree.
Yeah, the rationale behind it has been explained, and then we don't have somebody interpreting what your rationale might be, and they might even be interpreting it wrong.
Yeah. Our first conspiracy of the day from Kevin. Thanks for your comments during the week, Kevin. You're right, if Warrington had half those Saints players back from Warrington for the women's team, you'd be up there. Warrington need a good legal representation for the disciplinary panel, because we always seem to get more game bans than any other team. Why, it's not Warrington's year. And Paul Cullen's on the panel, you know, can have a word.
Every team thinks they get a hard deal from referees in the disciplinary panel.
In terms of, we'll go back, I'm sure over the course of this, we'll go backwards and forwards across your refereeing career, but what does the new role entail? Because we saw the press release, we've had a bit of an explanation as to why it's such a great opportunity, but most people probably won't fully understand why you're so excited about the contribution you can make.
So it's almost like the back house of any business in a way, the operational function within that business. So I was the head of legal for the last 12 months. Prior to that, I'd been in the legal team with the responsibility for various different areas, safeguarding being one of those particular areas. So I maintain my responsibility for all the legal functions. I also, as head of legal, had responsibility within my area for compliance and for safeguarding, and I'll maintain that in the new role. So I'm not losing anything that I've had for the last 12 months. I'll be able to do a bit more now in those two areas because I'll be full-time, therefore I can get involved in some of the compliance cases that perhaps I wouldn't have done in the past, which excites me. I think I can use the skill set of knowing the game, knowing the people, and my legal background to help there. But we have an exceptionally talented team in safeguarding and compliance. They work diligently and they do a really good job. The reality with that area of the business is it's bad news. You're delivering bad news regularly to people, and nobody will ever agree with the decision in the same way they don't agree with the refereeing decisions. What it also then entails is to be responsible for the regulatory and operational framework for the professional game. So that will be around fixtures, the nuts and bolts of shirt clashes. So when everybody's moaning on Sky next year, probably my fault. So shirts, rules, salary cap, all the areas that are perhaps dull and boring to some people, but actually are the most important part of the sport. It keeps it afloat, and it allows people to go out and either sell the sport or to play the sport. And then the final part of that jigsaw, the other part of that is then the medical standards, and there's some real big challenging areas in medical standards coming up, which is, as a professional, something that you really want to be involved in when things are changing and when the challenges are there. You want to be at the forefront of those discussions, and so I'll have some input into that. Taking advice from the science, you know, we'll be guided by the science.
Don't say. In a month's time, you won't.
And then the final bit, which is probably the most important thing for me, it is a responsibility for the regulatory framework around the community game. my background in the sport was always through the community game, in terms of my granddad was the president at Saddleworth from when I was born. My dad coached there. I've been involved in that club for a long time. My mum is now involved heavily at Saddleworth. My son plays the sport. I refereed in the community game. I volunteer in the community game. I volunteered in the community game before going into my job where I am now. It is the most important part of our sport, and I don't think it's underrepresented within the RFL, but I think I have a good enough understanding and background that I can be a loud voice for that area going forward, and that's probably the most exciting part of it for me, to be honest.
Difficult time, though, because you mentioned safeguarding, compliance. Whether or not the statistics back it up or not, there seems to be an issue with touchline behaviour, particularly in the community game. I think it does spill over into the professional game as well. But we saw the Huddersfield Referee Society take a stance the other week. We've heard, and you might say quite rightly, the fact that you hear about it more doesn't necessarily mean there is more of it. It just means that you hear about it more. Issues on touchlines involving junior teams. How do you stop that? And is that part of the brief that you'll be in?
Yeah, Matt, well, I think, if I was to say that, I think the three challenges or opportunities for the sport in the next 12, 24 months in my area of the sport are unacceptable language and behaviour, and really driving that agenda within our sport. And I think that's a real good opportunity for us to become a diverse, inclusive sport. We've got some great products in that area, and we need to become better in all those areas. Player safety is always a big issue within sport, especially in a contact sport. And I think, directly answering your question, adult behaviour and fan behaviour is something that's got to change, and it's got to change for the better. And social media doesn't help, Brexit doesn't help, all these other things that come into... You can't immune yourself from the society that you live in. Let's be
pretty
blunt.
Much divided.
However, we can say what's right and wrong in our sport and what we will accept, and we now have to get that right.
And does that involve greater sanction?
Possibly. I don't think sanction's just the only thing that can be done. I think greater education. And by greater sanction, I don't necessarily mean larger fines.
No.
Perhaps more serious sanctions. But different solutions. I think some of this has to be different solutions.
It's clearly a Tannoy announcement that is now laughed at is probably not sufficient to deal with a growing issue.
Probably not. But it's one of a number of measures you can take. I would say that Tannoy announcement goes out, everybody starts going, way, and it drowns it out. And then it does die down. So in a way, the Tannoy announcement works.
I'm not convinced of that. I think you've got a bit more work to do.
No, but... You know, We've got to get people in the room and make some decisions.
Can you have an impact on stewarding, for example? Because again, what a steward can, can't, won't, and is legally allowed to do has changed. The level of stewarding, particularly whether it's on a community touchline or at a professional game, seems to be less, as in there are less people involved in and around the stadium. There isn't a police presence at Super League anymore, which we don't want, but... Sometimes having it there is a deterrent in itself. Is all that come under your remit?
Yes. So we have got meetings with ground safety officers. There is a group, the ground safety officers group. We're meeting with them later in the year to plan for next year. We're meeting with the chief execs of clubs. Ultimately, this isn't an area that the RFL can resolve on its own.
No.
It's down to its clubs, its players, its volunteers to get in a room and come up with some solutions. I don't profess to have all the answers. I just know that the reality is that adult behaviour post-lockdown is at an all-time low. And that's not just in rugby league, it's in horse racing, it's in football. I get married later this year, the venue I was at told me that no one can drink anymore and that they're either all fighting or all falling over and getting injured. So perhaps it's just a societal thing that we're just not used to going out anymore. So I hope that will change. We'll do our best to make it change, but we don't have all the answers, and it's not down to the governing body to come up with all those answers, because the clubs deliver weekly events, and they are in charge of their own grounds, they have their own businesses, and so we can't come up with something that they say just doesn't work. We have
or
to make sure
or cost too much, because they've got books to balance in a very difficult economic time as well. So you could say, we need you to have 7,000
I accept that, but our clubs work extremely hard. Our clubs work extremely hard to make game day a good experience. They're not suddenly sitting on their hands and saying, we're not bothered about this. They know it's an issue and they want to do things better, and have probably worked harder in the last 18 months to deliver behind closed doors games than they've ever worked. And I know that from speaking to some of the most overworked and underpaid people at those clubs that just say, we're trying our best.
Presumably you've got the same issue with social media as well, because if the social media companies won't regulate in the way that most people think that they should, when people are saying or posting things that actually you think should be taken down, it's not a lot you can do to an individual and or somebody who professes to support a particular club that is putting out stuff that ideally you wouldn't want out there.
No. Sadly not.
But is that
and
an
we have to work, we,
you'll
yeah,
look at?
We will, and we'll have to look at how we engage on those mediums. We also have to think about pressuring government in the right way, and that's another area that I have responsibility for, to regulate those areas. And government are on board, aren't they? We're not alone, are we? You know, we're not alone. It's social media.
But it's
a fantastic thing.
All the things you're talking about don't have a simple solution.
No.
They're all interlinked. And
correct.
A lot of it is outside of your control.
And that's why it's so good a role to take on, because if everything was so easy to deal with, then we wouldn't need anybody in any jobs. But actually, the reason this is, it's a complicated area, and it needs someone to have a dedicated, open mind to how we change that, and perhaps a fresh look at that. But social media is a great thing in many ways.
So, Carsten, next time you are abused just for being German, you know who to get in touch with now. I mean, it can't help when there's a match on TV and teammate is playing and one of teammate's injured players is on social media criticising decisions made by the match officials, which are probably right, while the game's going on, and which causes supporters of teammate to then pile onto the match officials.
Yeah, and perhaps we're not great. We don't publish every decision that is taken against players and clubs. So a great number of decisions in that regard are low-level misconduct and therefore may result in a sanction, but I just don't think it's great for a sport to keep announcing every decision it makes when it's fined somebody or it's sanctioned somebody. And there's a fine line between having an opinion and that breaching your rules.
I guess as well in terms of, you mentioned sort of fixtures, how much say will you have over fixtures not overlapping, windows being in fixtures, putting the international game, again, dependent upon the IRL coming up with the calendar it keeps promising on. Will you be able to make sure we don't have the jam that we had last year when the All-Stars were playing at the same time as a Super League game? Is that what you mean by fixtures?
Yeah, well, we work with the clubs on fixtures, and it's not as simple as saying this will happen and that will happen. We've got to accept that Super League has to be in charge of its own calendar. The Championship has a certain number of fixtures to play. Super League have been brilliant, haven't they? They're starting a season to finish it early to allow the World Cup to start earlier.
But they're still having
so,
little fixtures in midweek.
Well, and all that will come out in the next few weeks for what fixtures this look like. But we have some involvement in that, and I oversee the department that runs that. It's about working together to get the right calendar. I think there's a longer term part to that, that with realignment potentially on the cards and with a short period to a new TV deal, we've got to get the product right on the field, and getting it right on the field needs to make sure we're playing the right amount of games at the right time. But you've got to do that for it. It's not a simple solution.
No, because there's an economic,
broadcasters, clubs need so many fixtures, players availability, coronavirus, pandemic,
player welfare.
There's so many areas to this that we could spend an hour on that alone in this meeting.
But I suspect also, will you have some remit over what the sport's going to look like going forward? So again, we're all assuming two divisions of 10 in 2023, because basically nobody's denying it. Do you have some say over whether that's good for the sport, bad for the sport, how we get from the fixtures of this year to the fixtures of that year?
The executive team work together on all these areas, and they work with Super League. We all work together. We all want the same thing, which is the right outcome for the sport. Nobody comes up with anything in our game for the wrong reasons. Whether it's the right thing, time will tell. It's all about consultation and making sure that we land in the right place for 23.
So where do you reckon we are at the moment? Because you've seen it close up on the field in terms of standard. You're involved in how it's looking at the moment, how it might look in the future. There is a lot of uncertainty, which is partly born out of the lives that we're all living at the moment. Is the sport healthy? Are we at the edge of a precipice? Are we at a crossroads? Are we got all of the things that are thrown at the sport on a regular basis?
They've said that for years, haven't they?
Oh, I've just thought 126.
I'm no historian, but you're far better than me. But in certainly, I go back as far as the 80s. And ever since then, so what's that? 34, 35 years, the game has been in some form of crisis. And it's been looking at, if it doesn't do this, this happens. And I remember Maurice Lindsay standing up and saying things in 96. And I remember things happening in 2017. And I remember things happening in 2010. And I think we always think that. And when we're all in a bubble, we all say, oh, God, the sport's in these crises.
And this could be one of those points in history.
It could be. I'm a glass half full person. Are the challenges? Yes. Are they insurmountable? I don't think so. And I think it'd be quite an exciting couple of years. What the key to that is, all the stakeholders have to row in together and come up with the solutions. And that's the most important thing for me would be, and I'm speaking without really, I'm not really in my new role yet, but from the start I've seen, clubs are extremely positive about what they're going to do. Do they face challenges? We'd be stupid to sit here and say they don't, but I don't know a business that really doesn't. We talk downstairs.
Absolutely.
Retail doesn't know what's going to happen in the December of 21, let alone what's going to happen in Super League at the end of 2022. So the world is in an age of uncertainty, but it's got some great opportunities. It's got some great partners. Sky have been with this sport an inordinate amount of time. They love this sport. They get involved in this sport heavily. Betfred have probably been the best partner for the sport that I can remember since probably the days of Silk Cut Challenge Cup. I only remember that she used to get a big box of cigarettes.
It is 200, yeah. just what you wanted at healthy.
So I think we've got some, and we've got other partners in the sport that have been around a long time now, Ron Seal, Datcher. We can't be in that bad a position.
But it's, again, it's about profile, because you're either up there and being seen and looking excited.
We were on the BBC on Saturday,
exactly.
And a fixture that was a friendly.
Because
was a friendly
it was
and thrown together. Well, it was a fixture that was thrown together when the World Cup got taken away from us, and the BBC took men's and women's international rugby league
on a Saturday,
and put it on BBC One.
Brilliant.
So we've got some profile.
Yeah, but is the danger that you're either a high-profile sport that people are talking about, or you're almost destined to be not on the pages of the newspapers, which you need to sell to sponsors and broadcasters. So which side of that coin are we slipping towards?
I don't think we're at the bottom end of that. I think we're closer to the top. We're on the big five sports. We're still in great position with government. I speak with colleagues in other sports who are in the same conversations when they speak with stakeholders who would say there are big challenges ahead, because we can't be naive to that. But the sport isn't as bad a shape as people think. I know people in football want rugby league to help them in certain things because government think we're such a great sport. I mean, talk about some of the positives.
Ironic, which government it is,
though. And everyone would say historically that rugby league did better under Labour governments. So
interesting.
Perhaps it just does better when governments need the North.
In terms of the World Cup, because again, clearly, that's going to have a massive impact. If it can produce games like Scotland and Jamaica in the group stages, then a lot of people are going to get excited about it. Are you involved in the legacy of the World Cup?
Not necessarily the legacy, but I've been involved with the World Cup. So when I joined the RFL in February 2011, one of my remits was to be involved and help with the legal side of the 2013 World Cup. which was a much smaller operation and was a fantastic success. It was probably one of the best successes of an international tournament in rugby league. It was better than 2017.
A lot better.
Don't let anybody ever tell you that 2017 was a better tournament. I was involved in both. 13 was a better tournament than 17. That was delivered by people from rugby league in England. So all these people who say we don't have great administrators, the 2013 World Cup was delivered better than an Australian World Cup in 2017. The 21 World Cup will be bigger and better. The people involved there are fantastic. We do have some involvement with them. We help them in terms of some of their legal aspects of stuff. We help them in terms of planning for disciplinary. We have to work with the IRL on that as well. So, yeah, I'm excited for that World Cup. I think that will give us another level of profile that we haven't seen for a significant period of time. Every game on the BBC. And go back to the other point.
Absolutely.
That was always due to happen in 21 when there was no other sport really in 21 happening. So the people can say, oh, the BBC took it because there was nothing else. What have we got next year? We've got a Commonwealth Games.
Mm.
We've got a Euros. We've got a World Cup.
Women's World Gymnastics.
Yeah, and we've got the World Cup on the BBC. Are we competing against those sports for eyeballs, potentially? But that's profile.
Mm. But how do you plan in advance how you're going to capitalise on that? And I'm not just talking
and
about
we have got people
the
working
legacy
together,
of
so,
facilities for community
yeah.
clubs, which is an actual legacy programme.
And our development team are working on that. So Mark Lovering and his team are working through all that with Karen oversees that, Karen Morehouse, because she sits on the board of the World Cup and the RFL. She oversees that with Alison O'Brien. There is a team dedicated to that within the RFL, and that partly explains why I come in to take
and,
some
and have they got care. Enough resource? Because you can never have enough. On the basis of the fact that no, they haven't. The answer to that is no. But have they got sufficient to make a difference?
Yeah. I think they're already making a difference.
Because, again, that's a story that doesn't get told enough.
So the community game has grown year on year. Community club game has grown year on year up to the pandemic. There was a fear that what would then happen was because of the pandemic we would lose people. Some of our leagues have come back bigger than they were pre-pandemic. Will our numbers look the same because of the way Sport England reports? I don't know. I don't think they will because we lost all our education settings one year. We lost all our community game in another year. But the facilities, some of the facilities grants and some of the facilities that are around now and some of the clubs that are bigger and better than they were, probably not got as many community adult teams as we used to have in the 80s, but we've got more community clubs and more boys playing and more girls playing than we've probably ever had. Look at the girls' story last week. Yeah. Growth again.
And in terms of that drop-off at 18, what impact the scholarship might be having, bringing back reserve grade, is that the right thing to do? How will that affect dual registration or loan system? Again, is that an area that you'll be
yeah, so that's the regulation of that comes under the operational rules and governs who can sign where and when. So some of that is with us. Without sounding like a broken record, it isn't just an isolated, that's the regulation team, they deal with that. You've got to consult with the clubs. You've got to go to the community board. You've got to go to the community clubs. The development team need to be involved under the coaching and the performance teams because everything has multi-layers to it. Pull one string on it. Mike Carter always talks about this. More and more, if you pull a string on a cord over here, it can affect five cords over here. So you've got to be careful when you're pulling different strings what you do.
Oh, in charge of squad numbers, you can't have Todd Carney wearing 99 at Salford. That was my favourite story forever. The operational rules, you should go read them. They're great fun. Tenny's asked an interesting question. Because you are closer to the players than anyone else on the field. Who is the most talented player you've ever reffed, and who do you think is the best in Super League at the minute? Or who do you enjoy watching as you're there in the heat of the action?
Good question.
Or do you actually notice them? I don't know.
I think you do and blocks. You don't. I mean, sometimes you can think things happen that don't. So it's not as you have a job to do when you're on the field. So it's not as easy to say that. I think you can still appreciate good players. There's a lot of good players around.
The
best player I've ever refereed, I think, would probably be Cameron Smith.
Didn't score as many tries as James Robbie, though.
And more from a point of view of how clever he was than necessarily how skillful a player he was. He was just such... He had an ability to know what and when and how to slow the game down or to speed the game up or whatever, and he just had that ability. So he was probably the best player I've refereed. Who do I like watching in Super League now? I like watching a number of players. I think there's a lot of talent out there. People underestimate how good the talent is in Super League.
As you mentioned Danny Maguire and Kevin Sinfield earlier, what's it like when they come up to you and try to... I mean, they're
referee the game, that's what you want to say.
It's a pantomime, though, isn't it?
People are saying that.
It's a pantomime. It's just a pantomime. It's genuinely just a pantomime. It's a game.
There was a bit in the Featherstone Halifax game a couple of weeks ago on the telly. You had a conversation with Brett Ferris, and we only heard half of it after I think he kicked a touch or something.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I thought, I'd want to hear what the other half of the conversation was.
Yeah, you've got to pick your moments. You've got to be careful sometimes because things can be taken out of context. But I was stood next to him, and I think it was Tom Holmes who should have kicked, and they made a bit of an error, didn't they? And he ended up with the ball and booted it. It was a great kick, wasn't it? And I said to him, I says, they're paying him all this money, and you can kick like that? But, I mean, I don't know what they're paying either of them. So, I mean, Brett might be on more than Tom, so it might not matter.
Is it hard to get that right then? Because obviously you want to have a good relationship with the players, but not wind them up.
Yeah, I think the thing I find hardest to say is when people say that you're arrogant because they don't know you. I think they mistake confidence for arrogance, and we have to sell decisions to audiences, to fans, to people in the stadium, and to the players. I maintain a belief that players smell weakness, and once they know they've got you, you're in a problem position. But relationship management is massive for referees. And it's done in different ways.
I was going to say, I think we've spoken about that before, with the death of Billy Thompson, that effectively you had two routes you could have gone down in how you manage a game. There was the Fred Lindop school, there was the Billy Thompson school. And I'm assuming that you hope that you've been an influence on this young generation that are coming through. But you'll have a way that you want to see a game refereed.
Yeah, I thought it was nice that a couple of the referees I've spoken to since finishing have said what influence you've had on their career. And I also know that the more experienced refs you talk to, they say the similar things. And you do learn off one another. That's the reality of, that's the blessing of full-time. That you take the best of other people. You try things of other people and they sometimes work and they sometimes don't. And you've got to play to your strengths. So Chris Kendall is the fittest referee in the full-time group. He needs to use that as a strength, and he does. Liam Moore is probably the best talker in the full-time group in terms of managing players now. He uses that to his strength, and that's what you've got to do. You've just got to learn what your strengths are.
So who was the biggest influence on you? I already know.
I think I said Stuart to you when we were talking last time. He probably was the best referee I can remember. And he came through. There always seems to be two refs of an era, doesn't there? I mean, it was Ben and I for a couple of years. It's got shorter as time has gone on, but it was Richard and Phil at one point. It was Ashley and Steve at one point. It was me and Ben. Now it's Chris and Liam. You seem to have a cycle and it come and go. I think full-time refereeing has shortened that cycle down. But when I was coming through, it was either Russ or Stuart. Stuart was an incredible referee, so calm, could just deal with anything and had an ability to let anything wash over him without having to change. And that was the biggest thing I took from him. He was a really good communicator.
I think he was mentioned in the commentary on Saturday. It must have been mentioned recently because I remember listening and hearing this. And is it a conscious thing during, say, a grand final, a big playoff game, an international, like, you referee things differently? There's always the accusation in Australia, isn't there? Origin is referee completely differently to any to Souths versus Newcastle.
Well, I think Origin used to be refereed differently to anything else, and I think they would admit to that in the NRL.
And I think they wanted it to be.
I don't think it is anymore, by the way, because the game won't allow you to do that because of player safety. No, I don't think they are. What you've got to remember is by the time you get to playoffs, you've generally got the best two teams in a competition, both determined to win, therefore playing at their best and limiting their discipline. And ultimately, they've played all year, so they're ready for that game. Starting February, you've played two pre-season games, you might play 40 minutes in total. Your like timing might not be quite right. You're trying new tactics, you're trying new things for a season. So that's why I think discipline improves as the season goes on. Plus, I think players start to understand where referees have got to in terms of a season and they've adapted to that. The grand final had a lot of penalties in it. People don't understand there was a lot of penalties. The grand final probably had the most penalties a final has had for a significant period of time. Didn't feel that way because the intensity was so good.
Yellow card and everything.
First ever.
But no penalty trap. No, I'm not even going
there. I've not seen it. I was busy. So I've not seen the final.
It was a great final.
It looked, from the bits I saw, it looked good.
It was probably the best grand final bar last year's grand final. The last two grand finals have been the best two games of domestic rugby league I can remember in a long time.
I think the drama of the year before...
The end.
Probably influenced the end. Maybe the first 60 minutes.
I thought the game was pretty good.
I thought this year was different.
I thought this was an outstanding game. And you've got to give the referee some credit for that.
Oh, absolutely.
People don't...
I did on
they want to give the referee a load of a hassle for decisions. But the referee is in charge of making the game faster and keeping a control of a 10.
Creating an event.
Yeah, exactly. So for all there were decisions in that game that could go either way, because no decision can, as I said, it's not black and it's not white, there were decisions that could have gone either way. And had they gone the other way, a lot of other people would have found criticism in Liam. I thought Liam refereed the grand final brilliantly.
We're pro refs, aren't we, though?
We've always been pro refs.
Anti players, pro refs.
Definitely anti players. No, we love them all.
Do we?
Well, some of you don't.
we talked about the behaviour of people on touchlines, especially at junior games. I guess in a Super League, I mean, geez, I'll have booed referees when I was younger and more naive, like last week, but. When you hear stories of what happens at junior games, and I refereed a junior sport, a different sport, 20-odd years ago, and I remember some of the abuse. Not serious abuse, but, not nice. That must be really off-putting to these young, especially the young referees who are coming through, who we need to replace the likes of you coming forward.
A lot of referees at junior level are children. So you're abusing a child.
This back to safeguarding again.
You're abusing a child. So that's what we need to start thinking about. And you want more refs. You've got to accept that they're not me of 25 years refereeing experience when they're doing the third game. And that probably the refereeing an under-13s game and those players on the field aren't Sam Tompkins, Zach Hardacre, Brett Ferris. They are learning the game as well. So we actually have to get back to that junior rugby is kids playing, enjoying and learning to play. Should we encourage them to want to win things? Absolutely. I'm not trying to get around this point. I accept that primary rugby league shouldn't be for winners. There should be no winners, no losers. You should get them to develop their skills, small-sided games. Let's get more players playing and let's get them enjoying it. But there comes a point when you're playing 13-a-side rugby, yes, teach them to win, teach them the dignity to lose as well. Teach them that there's an ability that actually, if you lose because the team is better than you, or because you made a mistake, that's what happens in life. And we'll learn from that and we'll move on to next week. But let's stop abusing kids. Stop putting kids in an environment where they feel uncomfortable. We did a whole game review, and the players, the children, were saying that's one of the reasons they stopped playing. They didn't say that it was because, some did say, the standard of referee needed to improve. But more were saying, a lot more were saying, the environment that we are playing in is not right. So let's get that out on the table. Adults, parents, what would you do if I abused your son because he dropped the ball when a referee missed a knock-on? That's what they don't get their head round. And actually, we've got to stamp that out and stamp it out significantly.
Because we see the letters in the paper and on social media. We've got to improve referees.
I assume absolutely. I think there's no denying... We have to improve everything in our sport because if you stand still, you go backwards because that's what happens in life. So do we need to improve our referees? Yes. Does that mean they're not good? No. And they need opportunities. They need to be given the chance to do well. And people have to accept that in Super League, there are probably less errors by referees than there are by the teams because that's the way a game goes. And there'll be some errors that people won't even notice of a referee and there'll be some errors that they do see. Do we want to stop the howlers? Yeah. Have we all made howlers? Absolutely.
And has a referee ever determined the outcome of a game with a wrong decision?
Do you want me to answer?
Over the other 79... No,
Neil Summers.
The other 79 minutes, it's been in the hands of the teams to determine their own.
And a decision that might result in a try or a no try, there is then, from there, another period of play and somebody else may score. If somebody scores and kick off, they might drop the kick off.
I think the other thing about the Huddersfield Referee Society when they took their stand was that they were talking about they didn't feel that the disciplinary sanctions backed up the fact that their referees were coming under pressure. Again, is that an area that you will look at?
And that's what we are looking at. We've got a summit coming up in the next couple of weeks with a number of stakeholders to look at this. I felt a bit sorry for the Yorkshire Junior League in that situation. The Huddersfield Referee Society rightly were unhappy with a decision. And there has been an issue with referee abuse going on a long, long time. But that particular league got a lot of hassle and its volunteers have been doing a lot of work to try and improve things. But do they need to do more? Yes. Does the sport need to do more? Yes. Do referees need to do more? Yes. We have to, as a game, change things, not just keep saying we're pulling out and we're doing that. They perhaps needed to do that, and by doing what they did, they may have lanced a boil, potentially. But that summit was happening anyway at the end of the year, but it has given us an added determination that we need to stop.
Took me about a minute to work it out. Millennium Stadium, Bradford versus Leeds.
But at that point, there's already been about a million and one decisions in the game.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't take the logic away from that.
Bradford could have been so far ahead that didn't matter.
And now they don't exist anymore. Phil has been on. We've blamed society, we've blamed Brexit. Now I'm going to blame football because Phil asks, does Rob think that bad habits are creeping into the game, players appealing for 10 in the bin and penalties, etc., doing the imaginary yellow card?
Yeah, a little bit of that creeped in, didn't it? And we've had a few players dive. I think we stamp that out pretty quickly every time. It rears its head once a season normally. Something happens and then that gets stamped down again and it's stopped.
It is one of the other issues, again, what might be perhaps unfairly termed gamesmanship, because clearly the coaches are there to bend the rules as far as they can to their advantage. And any coach that you speak to says that I need to do that. If we play a certain way, I need to make sure that the ruck's slow or fast or whatever it is. But do we now have, because you've already pointed out, this need to be so careful, particularly about head injuries, that you're finding teams are exploiting, oh, it's a dropout suddenly, there's a player that needs treatment, it's slowing the game down to their advantage. There's nothing you can do, because if there is a potential head injury, you have to stop the game and allow the trainer or the doctor.
No, and we have policies in place which cover what we can and can't do.
But are you seeing more of an incidence?
Well, we have, and I think you've seen some rule changes that the devil will be in the detail, as I think one or two people have said, but we're working through that detail at the minute, and I think you'll see that there'll be a positive outcome for that. And we have to react to things that happen. That's what happens in the sport. Something will happen in a few months' time and we'll have to react to that.
And in your role, you're talking about clearly the concussion debate and how we protect players and mouthguard technology and the ongoing debate about whether they should wear a protective hat or not. All of that. Will you involve some of the players, like, for example, Stevie Ward, who have suffered at the moment what Tom Johnson's going through, and say we need to bring your lived experience into some of the decisions?
I think we do that already.
Because I think they feel a bit isolated.
I think we do that already. We reach out to people and ask for their help in respect of different areas, and we look for the right expertise. We have a good relationship with the union. The union represent players. They have an in to those people as well. So yeah, we do that.
Well, people need to be told that the game isn't just being allowed to.
No, and that's the point. I mean, we are adapting all the time. You're right, I think we've got the mouthguard technology now is something that will be used again next year. Starting to get a bit more data, start to understand a bit more as well. See what comes.
Game's gone soft. That's what people say.
Who's doing the tea and coffee this week? It's Robert Hicks, isn't it? Because isn't he retired? No. Oh, no, he's here. I'll get the dough.
Kevin says you can understand the on-field refs making mistakes, but when the video ref gets it wrong after looking numerous times in slow motion. Oh dear, Kevin. You didn't make any mistakes the weekend, though, did you?
I don't think so, no. I got told I was right on all my decisions. That's an unusual.
Ian says he's enjoyed it this year when you refereed some Halifax games. The games seem to flow better. If they'd known you'd been retiring, they'd have given you a round of applause if you did your warm-ups before the match. Here's Teddy. Now, if people don't moan about the advanced shoulder charges or whatever, then what they really moan about is the play of the ball, because it is a mess. Everyone says this. Teddy says, there's been a few play the ball rule clarifications lately, but still Super League players generally don't use their feet to play the ball. Why not? It's your fault.
We're not going through every single rule.
Ah. Oh, it could do. The kickoff. They're always offside.
Yeah, I think the play the ball is better than it has been for a long time now. We've got rid of players falling back to the floor as they play the ball, and most players now play it on the mark. And I think the play the ball has improved this last 18 months when you take into account the back end of last season.
Everyone's pointing these things out and saying, no, it's actually not as bad as you think.
I was going to ask about speed of the game, because clearly the six-again rule, not having scrums, all of that came in during a lockdown period, so you didn't really have time to prepare for it. Did you notice that there was a consummate increase in speed of the game?
The ball was in play more. I'm not so sure the game was significantly faster. The ball was in play more. The game felt a little bit more intense. I think it's like any rule change. Players start to adapt to a rule change as time goes on, and I think by the end of last season, it had all settled back down to it.
But do you have to cover more ground?
No, I don't think we were covering much more than we were anyway. I think the games were of a similar... They were just longer. Shorter, but the ball was in play longer.
Six-again rule, again, is one that... It's an interesting one, because there hasn't been a lot of education about what it's given for. One of the great assets of rugby league is sometimes its simplicity of being able to explain it to someone who isn't an aficionado. So the ball is always visible. You need to get to that end, or you need to get to that end. And you've got a number of opportunities, and that's it. You don't need to know a lot more. It's harder to explain to a neutral why a six again has been given. Do we need to do a bit more work if that's going to become such an integral part of the sport going forward?
Possibly. I mean, a six again is only given when a penalty would have been given in a game anyway.
Right.
So, it's only the same thing of why you have to explain why your penalty was now given. I think where we have to work better is to allow the game to know that there's been a six again.
Yeah.
We've got to find a way in the Championship, specifically in League One.
There weren't any at Jamaica and Scotland. I mean, there were lots of six agains, but there was no way of signalling to the crowd.
Because the referee signals six again by waving his arm, which is only back to one. And he could be signalling that because there's a knock-on and it's a zero tackle. It could be any reason. It could be off of 20. So we need to do a bit more there. We should try and do more on the rules. I think we can actually do more education there. I think that's right. And I know we have some plans afoot to try and improve knowledge.
Would you think of live streaming disciplinaries? So that, again, it takes away that... It's a conspiracy, my team always gets more.
I get intrigued by this conspiracy theory, because teams get a penalty notice. They get told that that's what the charge... Basically, you are guilty of a grade A high tackle. If the club accept that, they've accepted that. And I still see clubs saying, it's wrong, it's wrong. Well, the club even think it's right. So, I know clubs might turn around and say, we accept because we might get another game. But deep down, they only get another game if it's frivolous. So yeah. So by accepting, they've actually accepted that the charge that's brought is right. Should we live stream disciplinaries? You'd have to be a really rugby league nerd to watch those.
It's like live streaming court cases.
That's my way to sort it.
No, I think there is a market for it, by the way.
Absolutely.
$4.95 hour league.
And I think the other thing I'd say on it is that actually, if somebody had a big concern about a particular case, going watching it would help them in that regard. I think it's one to consider.
Because it's all about education. And that's something that you brought up early on that is absolutely right. And if you can actually show that the process that has gone through, you still may not like the answer, but you can't fault the process.
Yeah, I think we can do a bit more in terms of what is released.
And will that
on
be
decisions.
Part of what you can do?
Yes, that's we've released a few more of our off-field decisions this year than we normally would have done. I think we'll move more to that in an attempt to try
transparency.
And for people to understand, because what's that phrase that people used to say? I believe all of what you see, half of what you hear, and none of what you read. And then I think, like, you've got to look at the misinformation on social media, that actually people could misinterpret what's happened in an incident. And when you actually know the facts, you get really annoyed at them getting mad at a verdict, and you're thinking, well, you don't know the facts. And, well, perhaps that's for us, therefore, to say the facts. We've just got to be careful there, because some cases are confidential, some are, you need to redact certain things. But I would like us to be a little bit more open in regard to what we do release. And we have done that more this year. We did it on a couple of our unacceptable language cases, and we did it on a rather complicated off-field matter to try and explain to people why the decision was what it was.
I think that's the one I'm thinking of.
Knowing you, it probably
don't
is.
Mention that one. You signed a player who got done for bad language last year.
I have.
Well, you're Leeds, aren't you? You're
Leeds. Oh, I see. Yeah. Okay.
She's going to go well, though. 6, possibly.
Or 13.
Or 13. International rules, says Kevin. Kevin's mentioned the differences. How annoying is it when there's a different set of rules for one game than there is to another? How can we standardise things?
Well, we are closer to the international rules than any other part of the sport. So it's not as bad for us. This work started in 2013 to bring the game to one set of rules. And I think it would help the game massively. If you watch football, it's played the same in every country it's played in. I think you can always have the odd local rule. I think that helps. Because of specifics.
Local conditions.
Well, you couldn't, for example, if you're playing in Cameroon and you haven't got touch judges, playing 40-20s and 20-40s is pretty impossible to do.
I've forgotten all about that.
If you're playing in Australia where every game is on TV, you can have a captain's challenge, but you can't have it in Super League where you only have two games on TV. So I don't think we're a million miles away from having that international rule book right. It's harder for the Australian refs than it is the English, because they have to change more than us.
50-30.
Well, having two referees and one referee was the classic example of dysfunction. But thankfully we've stopped that.
Kevin's asked us a question, Phil. I think I know the answer to this one anyway.
What's the biscuit?
Would we rather have behind-the-sticks officials or money spent on video referees? I'm assuming that having a video referee every game costs a bit more than having two people still at the back doing whatever they do.
I bet the video referee.
If they're all going to be...
My concern sometimes is it takes too long and it detracts from... When you're at an event...
Especially if there's no big screen there.
Yeah, there is a danger that if you look at something too many times, you overanalyse it, that the excitement of the moment of why we all go to sport is sometimes lost.
Mission creep, as Rod Studd would say.
So I think, you know, once you let it in, it's like, you know, you invent the atomic bomb. For all the disarmament talks you can have, it's about not deploying it, it's not about not having it anymore. So I think we've got the video referee, we just need to make the best use of it and the fairest use of it. It'd be very interesting if we're having more and more Super League games shown over time. You know, some on our league, some perhaps on a free-to-air broadcaster, if we can get them on board, because Sky allow us now to do that. Do they all have the same access to video referees? Is there any reason why they shouldn't?
And that will depend on the broadcast spec, won't it?
Yeah. So again, does the broadcast spec need to make an allowance for the fact that you still need to have a video referee, but you might not have as many angles on an R-League game as you would perhaps on a Super League game? So all of that, I think, is worthy of debate. I don't think we should get rid of it. I just think we should make sure that it doesn't take over the game.
I just remember my favourite conspiracy of the last few years was people believing the roulette wheel on the video referee thing was real. And that it was an element of chance there as to what decision you would get.
Yeah, and no amount of education can help in cases like that.
Here's Carsten. And if you watch BT, well, you won't watch BT Sports, because I don't watch it either, but people always slag off this, but... Does Robert think the referees are underrepresented in the media? Because obviously Stuart Cummings used to be on the telly.
Yeah.
No, I think the game focuses on refs too much. Mm. Actually, I'll be honest, I think refs don't want to be known. I'd like to go to the supermarket and not be known. Boom. All right. It's nice when people say, oh, yeah, yeah. And then It's great, yeah, but nine times out of ten, they just want to call you anyway. So well, we're over-focused on referees.
And there's all this referees should be interviewed after a game, and actually they shouldn't.
I think there's a time and a place for referees to explain decisions. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's necessarily explaining those decisions in the public domain. I think it's they are accountable to their boss. We'll see what comes. I doubt that would ever happen, but why don't we just talk about what happened on the field?
Well, maybe because the game doesn't have a spokesperson. A lot of people speak about the game, but we don't have a voice. It's something we've spoken about a lot. It doesn't have someone that is the go-to person to talk about the game, or if the game needs to project itself. It's got some people who can speak, but it hasn't got a spokesperson, and that goes right back, and Nigel will be the first to admit it, to the time when he was in charge and didn't want to. So is that a role that you can adopt?
It's not my role now, is it? I mean, my role is very much back house and to have a difference. And yeah, that's what I want to do.
But by coming on something like this and talking,
I think we can
so
educate
passionately
people
and
better.
Eloquently. Yeah, is that part of? Could that?
Yeah,
be part
I
of
think we
role?
Need to educate people on a lot of things, all the time. The game's getting a difficult position now in terms of the Our League Active membership scheme that's being rolled out and saying that it hasn't consulted and different things and again. You've got to be careful what you read and what you hear. There's a lot of debate there. Have we done enough? I don't know. I know what we have done, and it's been a hell of a lot of work, and I know it's been a hell of a lot of consultation with some people and some people who we've tried to engage with who haven't. That's how it works. So you can try and consult as much as you want, but some people want to and some people don't want to engage. In not answering your question, I think my short answer is this. Everybody involved in the sport wants the sport to be the best it can be, whether that be Ralph and the board of directors at the top, or whether that be my son who plays at under-10s, or his coach, or me as a coach, or whoever. I don't know anybody involved in the sport, genuinely, who is involved in it for anything other than the love of it. And I mean that in the nicest possible way. I know there are very, very talented people involved in this sport who don't get paid what they should get paid for the talents they have because they love this sport that much. And I find it particularly offensive of anybody who would say that that is not the case. Do people make mistakes? Yes, they do. And are some decisions incomprehensible when you don't know all the facts? Yes. And in hindsight, have we made every decision perfectly for the last 126 years? Clearly no. But we don't live in a utopic world where we all have 20/20 vision and hindsight. At the time, with the facts presented to us, have decisions been made in the best interests of the sport? Yes. Did they turn out to be? Probably not. But there's nobody who works in this sport who doesn't want it to succeed and want it to be the best thing it can be. We'll see how far we go with that. And that's where we have to be.
Carsten would definitely watch the disciplinary. The reason for the question is I like it when Robert or Ben are on podcasts or shows and explaining their decision making. I really like that, and yes, I am a nerd. See, there you go, that's the new podcast.
But I'm a nerd, so I would be honest, I am a nerd. I am a rugby league nerd. I would watch rugby league anytime, anywhere. I'm a sport nerd, but I'm specifically a rugby league nerd, and I want the sport to do very well. So I would watch the disciplinary.
In terms of, we've got to lose now in Super League. You've just come back from France, two trips to France. Good or a bad thing for Super League?
Time will tell, won't it? You know, a lot will depend upon how we take best control of that scenario. Would it have been great for Super League if Featherstone had been in and not to lose? Yes. Would it have been great if it had been Toulouse and not Featherstone? Yes, because it gives you a different opportunity, and both would have been good for different reasons. The reality the sport faces, it now has two teams in France, a potential for a French TV deal, and to make the sport have more of a profile in a different area. I was at Toulouse where there were 9,500. The week before I was in Catalan where there was a sellout for a playoff game, and coverage in L'Equipe, several other domestic organisations, they say they want to take the 25 World Cup. So if they are going to do that, we need Toulouse and Catalan to do very well. If Toulouse play Catalan and they get a 30,000 sellout stadium somewhere in France and they sell this to a new area, great. Will that help Super League? Potentially. Will it hinder them? Potentially because of the Sky deal? I don't know. I'm not across all that. I'm no broadcast expert. But the dice are where they are and you've got to play it. So let's play with what we've got. Let's not all start saying, oh, they don't bring any away fans. Or that will be challenging for clubs. I've no doubt about that. But when Toronto came into the Championship, I think four clubs got their highest crowd of the season.
Well, even in League One, you know, the first game they played, London Scholars had their.
So let's have a go at doing that. Let's try something different.
In terms of licensing, because again, I think we're at that point where all of this is valid debate, where the sport is at the moment. Every sport is talking about change, coming out of a situation it couldn't possibly have planned and perhaps needing to be something different, whether that's for economic reasons or appeal reasons. So I think everybody agrees change deserves to be on the agenda. Licensing always comes back as a discussion point. We now have a clear division between those who play the sport full-time, those who play it part-time. Criticism that's always levelled at licensing, and you would have been involved at a junior level, is that we didn't police it properly. We never really saw what its potential could be. We didn't perhaps sanction some clubs who promised but didn't deliver on certain things regarding a licence. Is any of that fair, and is it something that we should be looking at for the future?
It might be. I don't know is the honest answer. I think we need to take the next 6 to 12 months to get the sport to the next chapter of its story. And do that by not a wide-ranging consultation on different areas, but there are certain groups formed with relevant people from the sport involved that can decide what that is. And then they have to, once they agree what that looks like, they have to convince the other teams involved in their respective constituencies. But whatever we do, we need to think through thoroughly and get right, because I think this is our one opportunity to get it right on the back of the World Cup. I don't know if licensing is the right answer. I don't know if it worked, if it would have worked if policed differently, possibly. But I like promotion and relegation. What I don't like about promotion and relegation is it puts the team who is promoted at a significant disadvantage going forward, and it puts the team going down in a precarious financial position. So what we've got to make sure, whatever we come up with, if we have promotion and relegation, that the step from 1 to 2 is not that big, and therefore the top 3 or 4 teams in 2 are better than the bottom 3 or similar standard to the bottom 3 or 4 teams in 1. And I know a Super League chairman told me a long time ago why relegation doesn't work. If you're in a relegation battle, you can't sign players till you know you're out of that relegation battle. By that point, the teams who aren't in the relegation battle have signed all the best players, and you're in a never-ending cycle of always being in that tumble.
But that's also assuming that promotion, relegation and a licensing type system are mutually exclusive. And
correct.
They're not.
No, they're not.
Because if your licensing system is right, you're giving the oxygen to a club like Catalan when they first came in, 3-year moratorium on relegation. If they'd have got relegated in year 2, which they would have done their league position, would they have ever come back? Would they have been the force they are now 15 years later? Probably not. And that's the history.
We tried that with Paris as well, didn't we, of course?
It's the history
of the sport.
But do we need to be cleverer and recognise where we are and say, look, full-time needs something that means it can bring the spotlight on the sport and the money in. Part-time needs some events that, in its own right, like the 1895 Cup Final, Featherstone, York going to Wembley was an absolute highlight of this year, seeing their fans there and what it meant to them. And, you know, if you're the chairman of Barrow at the moment, you think, I could get a trip to Wembley next year. It's a real incentive. It doesn't mean that they couldn't ultimately find a financial backer, be promoted in some way. Is it more about you want to structure the season rather than a certain number of teams and that we now need to
and
find
all those
hybrid
points point to my point that if we use the period of time we've got now to work through what this looks like,
but
and ask those questions. Well, we're all part of that at the RFL in terms of the exec management team. We're all involved in discussions. Ultimately, we're not at the coalface. That is for those strategic groups and the realignment group to work through, because if everybody jumps in a room and all come up with their ideas, it'll be a talking shop. So what you've got to do is keep using the people who are in that coalface room to narrow down the issues, bring an issue out, have a talk around with their constituents and take it back into that room and break that down and get it right. I think we'll get that, by the way. I don't know whether it'll be licensing or 2 10s that people talk about or 14 or 12 or a 10 and a part-time division. I don't know what it'll look like, because it's not straightforward.
No.
You know, it's not straightforward. It's not something that should be rushed. And it eventually has to sell to broadcasters, to investors. And let's not forget, a lot of the people who spend money in rugby league are generally the club chairs, because they are generally underpinning the clubs to a significant tune and making sure they do well. So we need to keep them on board. And then finally, it's got to appeal to the fans, because they are the other constituent that put money in. So fans, broadcasters, commercial partners and investors slash chairman are the four parts that need to make those decisions, because it has to appeal to those four.
So would you be a fan of positive discrimination if it was in the interests of the sport? So let's take, for example, London going part-time. And London have had a team now for 40 years. The legacy of that is that London's best players tend to be picked off by the other clubs. But everybody keeps saying strategically London's important. If we had a strong team in London, we'd get more interest from media, whatever media means. It would be good for the sport for London to be strong. As part of a governing body, would you accept that sort of micromanagement of London and it's in the strategic interest of the sport, we'll give them dispensation in certain areas?
I think that depends on what your structure comes back with, firstly. And secondly, you've got to build a club, not a team.
Yeah.
If you're going to do that, you've got to build a club, not a team.
But does promotion and relegation push you towards building a team rather than a club?
Potentially not. But you could have promotion and relegation with a hybrid licensing system or moratorium system that would allow for that. These are all theoretical arguments.
I know. I'm just keen to know whether you can bring them to the table.
Well, I don't think I can, in all honesty, at the minute. I will take time to think what I think the sport should look like. That doesn't mean I'll have any say in that. I'm a fan of the sport, so I have an opinion, but my opinion is like your opinion, and it's like a fan's opinion or anyone else's. I come back to, let's see what that structure looks like. Let's stress test it in different ways to make sure it's survivable and it's engaging and it does meet those four criteria that I've said. And then, if we have to positively discriminate, then you can only positively discriminate if a club is built, not a team.
Did Aits undergo that stress testing before it was introduced?
I don't know.
No, I
don't know.
As a fan of the game, did we
get rid of it too soon?
I don't know. Or was the conventional wisdom at the time it's going to cause you the kind of problems that it did when it eventually was dropped? Because the worry is that we'll come up with another structure and in 5 years' time we'll be sat here going, when the next structure comes in...
Well, that's my point, really. That's why I'm saying whatever we come up with, let's make sure that's what we want for a period of time.
You'll remember Blake going around selling the concept of AIDS.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, spent nearly a year going to various constituent parts of the sport.
That was then and this is now.
And saying, this is it, we're only going to make this one change, it's the right change, and within 3 or 4 years...
See, I like the eights. I'm not saying it worked, by the way, but I did like the eights concept when it was sold to me. Did it get that stress testing? I think it got some stress testing through the clubs, because ultimately they voted for it. They accepted that was the way forward.
But do we need to take it out of the hands of the clubs to vote?
And I think that's why we've got these groups, isn't it? These groups have that ability to take it out of their hands and deliver something that might be linked to something bigger and therefore be able to say to the clubs, in the same way Morris did. I mean, we are dancing round a circle of 1995.
But Morris was prepared to take unpopular decisions, both with the public and within the game. Do you come to a point sometimes where somebody has got to be able to make a decision and say, you're going to be disadvantaged by it, but this is the decision we're going to make, rather than we're almost too democratic?
Have we not made unpopular decisions in the last 12 months?
No, circumstances forced our hand.
Have we not made those decisions, though, because we've been forced to? Well, we've made those decisions.
I'm not sure anybody's
I think you're unfair on the people who have made those decisions in that regard. I think they have made unfair
decisions. No, I think we
decisions.
Concentrate the power in the hands of people that have vested interest in. And what nobody is really talking about is an alternative way of taking that. Just because they are investors, they deserve enormous credit for what they're doing.
But those people are now putting enormous stock in,
oh, absolutely,
in these groups that have been announced.
Although some aren't, because
let's see.
Go public and say,
yeah,
I don't agree with Toulouse coming in, before yeah. these groups have even reported.
Yeah, well, everyone's entitled to an opinion.
Yes.
I mean, there's no future for Rugby League in North America, we know that.
Well, there was a report that said so.
Exactly. Hello, Ottawa, if you're watching. You could move to Harrogate or, you know, anywhere.
Harrogate Aces.
Harrogate, Rotherham, Liverpool, all these places.
I think Hemel would be a really good place.
Do a list of them. Wakefield, we'll have another team. All right. See, if Fenton had gone up, we could have sold our TV deal to a Wakefield local television, which doesn't exist, but I could make it up. Anyway, Channel 4's in Leeds now, and BBC Sports in Manchester.
Is there not TV Leeds or something? I think you can still watch that on.
There is.
But I don't think there's any local content on it. Then.
When I always say to people, when Jeremy Hunt was the health secretary, he came up with the idea of these local TV stations no one watches. So that says where Jeremy Hunt is. That's enough politics. Too much politics today. Trevor is an American. Hello, Trevor. He's stuck watching a lot of American football. That's Sunday night, isn't he? Red Zone's the best thing on TV. The pace of the game is so important to rugby in keeping it interesting. Is there anything from other sports you think we could take from the way they officiate? I mean, if you watch the NFL, it takes so long to make decisions sometimes because they've got 700 referees on the field and then they still go to a video and there's a man in New York watching it as well.
American football's all about the adverts, isn't it?
Brilliant.
Sunday night telly.
It's brilliant when there's seven games on at the same time.
I think all sports have some positives in how they officiate. You can always find different ways from different sports. Rugby union's use of their video ref is a good system. Would it work in rugby league? I don't know, but it's a system I admire.
I guess you must be glad that you're not a football referee, because I can't remember ever seeing a rugby league game where players come up screaming to your face.
I think they do.
Microphone turned off.
I think they do. I can't remember us ever having a Roy Keane moment. I think that's partly because the referees wouldn't stand for it. But and I think our players are, on the whole,
exhausted.
Respectful.
Oh, sorry.
Just not on social media, some of them. Tim says, wearing his legal hat stroke wig, does Robert think Rugby League needs to introduce a fit and proper person protocol? Because the problem with the protocol is who you decide is fit and proper in the first place.
But a protocol is a protocol.
I think there is a fit and proper person test for people who are influential persons in clubs. I think it's there already.
Again, with a vested interest hat on, how important are foundations going to be for moving forward and getting out into the community, delivery of the sport at boys, girls, PDRL, LDRL? It can't solely be the responsibility of the club.
I think the better foundations already are out there doing a lot of excellent work.
Is that something you'll be able to regulate?
Yeah,
you've got
to be careful on regulating foundations because
they're the charities commission.
And they also, they don't just deal with rugby league. So, you know well at Leeds, Leeds' foundation, probably its rugby league arm is probably very small in its overall.
It's less significant than it certainly was when it was set up.
When it first set up. And the bigger the foundations get, the more they get into other areas. And they are massively important from a commercial perspective for clubs because they get their brand out there massively. They are also good for a social inclusion basis of rugby league.
And development.
I was heavily involved at the start with the regulation around PDRL and LDRL, which have gone on to become great successes of the sport, which they were born out of nothing in 2017. And we're talking about having a PDRL World Cup. Circumstances help, don't they? So Adam Hills getting on board with the PDRL was fantastic. And the LDRL piece that was on The One Show the other week. But without the foundations, you can't really run those kinds of products or wheelchair rugby league.
People expect the RFL to run that, and they can't.
No, they
haven't got the resource.
But it's not just that. So in terms of LDRL, you've got to have relevantly qualified people who can look after very vulnerable people, both physically and mentally. So foundations will be big for that. They're also very big at getting into schools, and schools is an area that we have to get into to sell our brand. And So I think foundations will always be. They have been for the last, certainly since I've been involved in the community game, since 2013, they've been heavily involved. It increased significantly in the last Sport England funding cycle. I think it will increase again in the next one. They in effect are our bags and balls and cones on the ground.
Yeah, they're what we're...
And community clubs are massive, but they can't go into... Not many community clubs are big enough and have volunteers that are skilled enough and time to go into the local schools. So you need the foundation to go into an area of Winmore and get the kids out.
And that's
and
what sold it to government as well. Yeah. The fact that we are in the most deprived... We, being the sport, are in the most deprived areas, which is something, again, that has a social attachment in terms of funding to it. But I think we don't make enough of it. We
try to make a lot of it. No, we've done the Rugby League Dividend Report. I think that showed a lot of what we've done. We're still trying to do more. We are also a relatively small governing body having to wear so many hats.
But again, does every club that calls itself a Super League club have to have a foundation of a certain size or the ability to operate in that manner? Is that, again, something you could look to?
Yeah, well, I would answer it in the way I said earlier. For me, Super League clubs need to be more than a team. They need to be a club that's sustainable, that's thriving, that's a good place for people to work, to go and watch, that can buy into their brand, that can engage in it. And its foundation will be a big arm for that.
A men's team, a women's team, a PDR team.
And a lot are starting to run those, aren't they? Yeah, a lot are starting to run more and more.
We've had we talk about diversity in terms of the game, the sport, the various components. We've had the Tackle It campaign for the last 12 months and the 13 seconds pause before each game. What about diversity of match officials? What can we do to attract more people who are not just white men to become match officials in some sense? Not that you can force people to want to be a referee.
Well, I think it's wider than just referees. I think it's across the whole sport. So for a sport that prides itself on some historical figures of significance from a variety of background, do we do enough to get people involved in our sport? Probably no, is the short answer. Not for any fault of anybody else's, that we've just not done enough. And as I said, small teams, not an ability to gain that. We have an inclusion board now. We're recruiting an inclusion lead. We're trying to do more in those areas. I'd speak with Mike Lawrence a couple of times already. I'd like to speak to him again. He's the rep on the inclusion board for players. I know Alex Simmons is very passionate in this area. We have to understand, firstly, what the hook is to get these people involved in our sport. But then it's all well and good bringing them in. You've then got to deal with the issues that come with bringing these people in respect of they are some horrible people on social media that abuse people. Marcus Rashford missed a penalty. He missed a penalty on social media because of the colour of his skin. It's nothing to do with the fact he just missed a penalty. You know, like David Beckham's missed penalties and Chris Waddle missed a penalty and Gareth Southgate missed a penalty. So it's a sad fact of life, and come back to you can't immune yourself from society, but we've got to grasp those areas well and deal with those. And that would be something I can help with in that area. I think we don't do a bad job of trying to tackle those areas. We can always do more, and we're trying to do more. And that's why I say what I do about Mike, because he's been really influential in trying to help me understand some of the issues around how you report an incident. Because the unfortunate thing, if you get an incident like that, is you get a pretty legal process, because everybody's a right to a fair hearing. So if I'm accused of abusing someone and using unacceptable language, and I deny it, it ends up with an investigation, people giving statements. It then ends up with going to a tribunal in front of a chair and me having to regurgitate my story. And there's a really good article, there's a Guardian article on this, that actually, to the person who's been abused, they've been abused in the most horrible personal way they could have ever been abused, actually. Probably for no real reason than the obvious, that somebody's just ignorant. But they've been abused. They've then had to tell that story to somebody after being abused about the most personal things that really holds them. your heritage is the most important thing to you. I talk a lot about my dad and my granddad and my mum and people like that. And people from diverse backgrounds, they have a real rich heritage. So they've been abused on that front. They've had to tell the story to somebody once. They've then been questioned about it. Oh, and then there's a risk that they might get told they're not believed. So actually, why do they want to go through that 3-4 times to get there? And we've got to understand it. And I can never live that experience. Yeah, yeah. All I can ever do is empathise in that experience. But we've got to understand how we can do that differently and better to allow that to happen. So when I first got involved in safeguarding at the RFL, we dealt with probably somewhere about 40 to 50 cases a year. That's now up to nearly 300 a year. That's not saying that we have an issue with safeguarding in the sport. What we've actually done is raised awareness to people to say, if you aren't happy about what happens, we have a fair, open, transparent process that you can come and report something in a confidential way. They'll be treated securely, they'll be treated sympathetically, and we'll give you a listening, an airing and a proper judgment. And that's what we need to make sure we're doing it with the inclusion. That's potentially how we get more referees in. The National Conference League Referee of the Year, Aaron Belafonte, is black. Liam Rush, who's one of our most up-and-coming referees at the top level, is a grade one, is of mixed heritage. He has suffered abuse. He nearly walked away from the game because of that abuse. I'm sure we've lost a lot of players because of that. Mikolaj Ledski played in a game at Leeds the other day and spoke so articulately after the game on social media about it. And Andre did in respect of what happened in his case. We've got to use more of that, because I think that's more hard-hitting for people. You'll never convince everybody that inclusion and diversity is the right way forward, by the way. You just won't. But I think the vast majority of people who are involved in rugby league would listen more to the lived experiences, and we can educate people in that regard. And move away from, it was banter, it was an in-joke, all this nonsense that's out there, you know?
Do you think we've done the 13 seconds well? Or has it become, through nobody's fault, perhaps, tokenism?
Well, I mean, I was stood at a game film and heard someone in the crowd say, get up off your knees, you bastards.
Yeah.
You know, and those are people you're not going to change the opinion of.
Has the game almost watered down what it was trying to achieve?
The game was led by its players, so it was all player-led, the 13 seconds. We need to look at that for the start of next year and make sure that whatever we are doing is sending the right message for the right reasons for people. I think, again, if you listen to people like Michael Lawrence or Kevin Nakama, who was at St Helens, both those teams took a knee regularly. Yeah, if you watch the women's game, nearly all the girls were women who played the sport take a knee. Okay? They, specifically Huddersfield and St Helens, I think the reason why they took a knee was because they fully understood what it meant to the people in that team about these instances. Let's not get drawn into the social media arguments around it being about, but it needs to be a personal choice for people. You can't force people, otherwise you end up in an inordinate mess like the South African cricket team has ended up in today.
Yeah.
So let's not force everybody to say you must do something, but let's make sure what we're doing is respectful, done for the right reasons, and
it's understood.
And
is
by
that,
everybody.
Again, is that something that you'll be involved?
Yes. So one of the areas I'm involved in is around player education in certain areas, and inclusion and diversity is one of those. And as I said at the start, if I was to say the three things I would like to make a difference in are unacceptable language and behaviour, player safety, and ultimately crowd and adult behaviour.
And I'm extremely conscious that we're probably the wrong people to be speaking about this because of our...
Well, and ultimately, we are three middle-aged, middle-class
Well,
men.
You're very kind. I'd like to be
And that's why I say to you, it's very wrong for me to sit here and say our processes around reporting of abuse and unacceptable language are brilliant and they're the best. I think they're very good. But do they take into account those lived experiences? Not totally. Have we done a lot to change that massively? And this year, as part of the recruitment drive we had around the operational rules tribunals, we brought people in from different and diverse backgrounds. And we've now got voices in those rooms that not only will they make decisions, but they will also be in a room at the end of a year when we debrief on all our cases, and they'll be able to say, when you made that decision here and you said X or you said Y, you completely offended me, and you offended me because of this, this, and this. And the people in that room are intelligent, they're articulate. They're saying things for probably what they thought were the best reasons, but they are like you and I were in terms of they are middle class, middle white.
We're trying to learn.
Middle-aged white. Yeah. They're trying to learn. So to have those in the room will make a massive difference to that decision-making process. And we need to find more of those people and bring them through to referee, to coach, to play. Some of our best players have been of a black heritage.
Oh, absolutely.
Because the Rugby League media press box, that's completely diverse, isn't it, Phil? Oh, massively diverse.
Only in age.
We also have to accept, though, as well, that we're now opening up ourselves to LDRL, PDRL, wheelchair, women, girls. They have an equal say in how this sport should be run, should be governed, should look like. We need to have those kinds of people in decision-making bodies, whether that be a community board, whether it be on the RFL board, in clubs. Ultimately, clubs make big decisions.
Absolutely.
What do their boards look like? We need to do more work there.
In the short term, is there more travel in the women's PDRL, DRL, wheelchair than the men's game? Because, again, that's something new that we've all got to consider.
Well, there's more growth in them because, ultimately, you're growing from a relatively small base from comparing it with the men's game.
Is there more external interest from people like broadcasters, potential sponsors, in that part of the game? And that we spent 126 years concentrating on where does the men's game go. But actually, where we are at the moment, there is more potential for the sport in these other areas.
The BBC took the England women's game.
Well, and
Sky
also,
TV took the women's grand final.
Be taking the wheelchair test.
Yes, and they took the Challenge Cup final. And so it tells you that broadcasters are interested in those areas. Is there a broadcast market that pays significant sums? I don't genuinely know. Will they just because broadcast is a little bit more complicated than just saying we're going to put every game on TV because you've got the cost of the setup, you've got to pay commentators, you've got to then pay for a fee to take that back to a certain area. So whether there is that kind of market, I don't know. But there is a way of raising awareness of these areas of our sport which gets more people playing. Mm. Ultimately, I think partners are a lot more interested in a sport that can offer it. PDRL, LDRL, wheelchair, boys, girls, women, men, all these different types of the sport. You don't have to suddenly come up with the magic pill of our version of 2020 cricket or the 100. What you might have to do is concentrate on what you've already got and make that the best it can be.
Yeah, I think corporate social responsibility, or whatever it's now called this week, means that what we offer to potential funders is the broadest that any sport can offer. But I think we have spent too much time overlooking the men's game and what that's going to be and how that's going to take us, but are not enough saying actually what we've got, if we're looking for where we go in the future and it looks slightly different, is, well, how many men's games are going to be preceded by a women's game? So if a broadcaster does want to feature that, there isn't two set-up costs. And actually, you know, we'll put two wheelchair games on at the same venue because actually there is a massive audience for that. And you know, PDRL should be viewed as not to be played on a field
I think they're all valid points. I think they're all valid points, and I think, as I said to you earlier, I'm sure I know that those conversations are happening in these groups, and we're talking about different ways of basically landing the sport to the relevant partners and the relevant funders to say, here we go, because sport needs funding. You can't, sadly, the real world now is you can't do everything for nothing.
No.
You know, I'm going back to being political. There is no way a Tory Chancellor is going to stand up tomorrow and put 1p on national insurance because he thinks it's the best way to run a fiscally conservative economy. He doesn't. It will be anti what he thinks. But the reality is you can't keep spending on healthcare, spending on social care, spending on schools, catching up because of COVID, paying for furlough and eventually not bring some money in somewhere else. And Rugby League, in its own little way, has the same thing to do. It has to fund what it does and it has to bring money in from wherever it can to do that. And it's not as straightforward as saying you should get more from your TV deal. Okay, perhaps you should. But is any sport getting more for a TV deal at the minute? I don't think they are.
No, I just think there's that anomaly between, you just said the last two grand finals were as good as we've seen, but the value of the broadcaster who showed those grand finals has gone down by 40%, partly because there's no competition in the market. Well, that's our fault that there isn't competition in the market.
I don't compare apples with oranges, but we were dealing with a contract for a broadcast deal out of a pandemic when a lot of other things were happening, when other sports had already lost money on their TV deal pre-pandemic, and our last TV renewal was in 2014.
And was a long, lucrative deal.
Perhaps that was a great deal. And I'm not so sure, in terms of the actual finite detail, whether the deal is the same number of games, same exclusivity. They pay for exclusivity of a sport at that period in 2014. They didn't pay for that this time round. Is it a good TV deal? It's as good a TV deal as we could have got. It's from a partner who is clearly committed to us, who have shown commitment to this sport since the early 90s, who put games on every week, who pay to put those games on because that's part of the deal, and have put a lot of effort into what they do. I don't buy into this argument that Sky don't love rugby league, because if they didn't love rugby league, they wouldn't do all that they do with it. Could they do things differently? Potentially. But they're as good a partner out there as there is.
If you, in your new role, weren't happy with the way the sport was being presented, which is not having a go at Sky or the BBC or anybody, but you felt that it could be shown in a slightly different light, would you feel confident to have that conversation? Because there are, again, keyboard warriors. We may have even promoted the odd agenda that nobody stands up and says, can we change how that looks or that feels?
We talked to him, and I know that Mark and his team and Rodri at Super League and his team, they have regular conversations with the broadcaster about how it looks and things like that. That's part of a partnership. I personally think there is too much focus on referees and referees' decisions. I think when they had Stuart on there, it made it even worse.
Yeah,
I think,
does it come because from that time?
It comes because Neville used to be, he was a referee. And Neville, but what great things Neville did for the sport.
Absolutely.
Right, so let me not look at that people saying the headline here is Robert Coles Neville, because I don't. But we need to move away from the whole sport forever and a day as known who its referees are. It's always known who they are, going back as far as Eric Clay. And it's obsessed with its refs. But actually, just stop obsessing with them.
Absolutely.
They come, they make decisions, they get some right, they get some wrong, they deal with the game, they go home. And I'm sure every referee would say the same thing. But everybody wants to talk about who the ref was. I've watched football for as long as I've watched rugby league. And I'm a referee, so I know referees. I can't remember who referees were in the 80s or the 90s. But I know everybody who I know who watches rugby league, they know who the refs were in the 80s and the 90s. They remember John Oldfield and Robin Whitfield. And they remember Colin Morris. And I'm like, really? Oh, they were good referees back in them days. And every referee's great when they retire. We're just obsessed with them, so that would be the one thing I would say generally.
Would you go on Sky as a guest and be asked about refereeing things, but just as a most knowledgeable fan about the game, talk about what we're watching?
Yeah, but I'd sooner hear from players.
Yeah.
I'd sooner hear from players. I think some of the pieces that Sky did last year with executives were insightful, raised debate, improved education of certain areas. I think we should do more of that with Sky, and we can do that through social media, because it's mainly through social media and website that, but we can do that. I just don't think we need to talk. I would much sooner hear how somebody break a game. I used to like when John Wells used to interview a player after the game, they used to break the game down, because actually from a lay fan's perspective, understanding what was going through a player's mind was great. I think we need to do more of that You can always change commentators. They're the best thing ever, aren't they? Eddie and Steve-O were called for brilliant. Years, and now are the best thing ever. You know, Ray French.
People love Eddie Waring now.
Yeah, Ray French was another one that people used to call, but is now the best commentator. Dave Woods, everyone used to say, oh, how good's Dave Woods now? And now because he's the regular commentator. No, I'm right. Because that's the way of the world.
I just wanted to point out, that's not me saying that. I like Dave.
Dave says that about himself, by the way, just for clarity.
I'll tell you actually if I'm going to have a biscuit. I'll have a biscuit when we're finished. Because you made me forget what I was going to say there. You know, I'm surprised about Sky's coverage, because my friend, we do a Sky quiz on a Saturday, and he was watching Sky, and there was nothing on. So he was watching Oldham versus St Helens, which was randomly on Saturday night.
Was that with the Bear running down the touchline?
No, this was pre-Bear. This was the big league. I'm surprised that now Neville's gone, they still kept the Try music. It's a relic of the 1990s, but it's still there. They can't get rid of it. Susan. Got a baton test. Everyone hates everything in rugby league. Referees, commentators, podcasts.
You said earlier, you know, when there are times where you've looked at the game and people have still been criticising it, but you stand back and you go, there's 70,000 people at Wembley, it's on the BBC, this great Wigan team, which everybody was saying, oh, it's destroying the game, so all their personalities are the ones we still remember. I think you can look at times and say, with the benefit of hindsight, that was a good time for the sport, that was a less edifying time, and we are at a point where we need to do something because the world has changed.
I don't disagree with the point that if I was to sit here and say the grand final attendance doesn't cause concern for anybody who's involved in the sport, I think I'd be very naive.
Or even
I
would lose a lot of credit. Attendance.
Yeah, these are things. But I listen to a number of people who sit on social media and moan about that attendance from the comfort of their own home.
Exactly.
And then the same people are then saying to me, and you should be paying for the community game. Well, if you went to the Challenge Cup final, we sold the Challenge Cup final every year. So flip this into rugby union. Rugby union has 6 internationals at home a year. Every year, Twickenham gets 6 times 80,000 people, give or take, all paying £40 a head, plus beer or whatever else. That money goes into rugby union. We don't have a stadium like that. We've never had a stadium like that.
Oh, we've got odds. We own that.
But,
well done, Phil.
But we've got, we have one major final a year. We have Magic. We have a grand final. And then we have a trip to Toulouse, a trip to Catalan, whatever else. There's so many times for people to do things. The world has changed. So when I was a child, if you didn't go to, probably the only time you went to London was for the Challenge Cup final. Yeah. So people either went on a lad's trip, they went on a family trip, but they always went to Wembley and there was all the different shirts. Now they can go to Magic. Now they can go and watch their team in Catalan or in Toulouse. Yeah. They can go to the grand final, which costs a lot less money because of transport. You can go there and back in the day. There's so many other things in the life that you can do. Kids aren't
but
as engaged
the
in
challenge, the Challenge Cup final itself has changed because it's always going to be between two Super League teams.
Yeah,
so
it's
another.
But we now have the 1895 Cup.
Exactly.
So we have an opportunity to change. I wish more people would go to those events because they're rugby league fans, rather than sitting at home and saying, I'm a rugby league fan, but I won't go and watch
it. Well, that's why
you
need
teams.
To sell 50 of your 76,000 tickets for the grand final before the season starts.
Yeah, potentially. Or the Challenge Cup final or whatever. I mean, we've got a Challenge Cup final next year at a brand new stadium, which is absolutely... I watched the NFL and that stadium looks phenomenal. Who've been to watch Tottenham at that ground say, you wouldn't believe how great a stadium it is. I'll guarantee there should be... I will go to that Challenge Cup final. I know other people who will go because it's at Tottenham. Yeah. But they should want to go because whoever's in that final, it shouldn't matter whether it's St Helens, Wakefield, Catalan, Toulouse. If it's Catalan and Toulouse, it doesn't matter. It's the Challenge Cup final. It's a major event. We're going to make a big deal of it. The grand final, whoever that is, the winner of that is the winner of the Super League. If you, as a rugby league fan, aren't engaged in that level, you don't really, in my opinion, have the right to then say, but you can't sell it to the people who aren't interested in rugby league. We have to sell to a non-event, an event-going audience, but similarly, if you can't sell it to
rugby league audiences,
and that's nothing to do with marketing, by the way. Let's get that myth out the way that I shouldn't have to tell a rugby... They know when the Challenge Cup final is, they know where it is, they know when the grand final is, they know where it is. If they are rugby league fans, they'll put it in their diary when it comes out and they'll go...
I think more of an issue is that we're an ageing population.
And we've had a pandemic.
And then the marketing
goes
into how you get young kids to relate to the game. What do they want out of it? As watchers, will they probably stop watching 80 minutes if they're not totally committed to
it? They watch it on TikTok, don't they?
Yeah. And how do we make it, you know, Twitch the go-to place or whatever? Is it Twitch? I don't know.
That is TikTok now, because it's only 30 seconds.
Whatever
they've extended it now.
So, you know, that to me is where you spend your marketing budget.
Well, my son told me that the posts had gone up at Old Trafford. I said, how do you know that? He said, it's on TikTok, Dad. They videoed the post going up on TikTok.
One of the best videos I've got is them taking the post down at Magic Weekend 1 year. People doing the grass at Wembley afterwards, because I think we were waiting after the 1895 Cup final that year, they chucked us out.
But we need to do that. We need to work out what it is that attracts the next generation and is safe as well in an environment.
It's when you find some young people who know anything that we don't. We're not allowed to go over 2 hours because that's only reserved for when Sandy comes in.
Unless you've got but that's only one question.
Yeah, unless you've got anything else you need to.
No, I just think that your role is... One of the reasons I want to get you on a path about you. The way you explain stuff, I think, is really important in this idea of educated people about what's going on in the game, not what they think might be going on in the game. But I just think the role that you're going to have is really incredibly important. That, yeah, the committees that are hopefully moving us in whatever direction we're going in, they're going to have the say on the money that's being brought in, the commercial partners we might be working with, the structure we might have. But underpinning that nobody sees is this area that you're going to be involved in. And I think explaining that and talking about that is really important.
Yeah, and as I said to you the other day when we spoke, I can cop criticism, and I think my whole team and the whole team at the RFL can cop criticism, but that criticism has to be in the right manner and for the right reasons, not because I've read on Twitter that something has happened. Why is there not a statement from the RFL? Why is there not a statement? Because the reality is, if we responded to every rumour that was on Twitter or every opinion that appeared, we'd never get any work done. I do think that the big thing I want to do is be more open and honest about what we're doing. Not because we haven't been in the past, but I want to do more of that. So like I said about the explaining of decisions, the publishing of decisions will be a big part of that.
Just do it on TikTok.
Yeah, got to find a way of doing it in a way that kids like it.
Referees doing dances on TikTok.
Putting up a card saying how many games somebody's
won. That kind of thing, yeah. Like the remember the Rugby League World Cup viral dance from 2013?
No.
It involved Josh Charlie in a warehouse. I don't think we should talk about Josh Charlie on social media. We'll be back at some point in the future. Rob, thank you very much for coming in.
No, thanks for having me.
Good luck
with
the new role.
Should we tell everybody we're going to be at Featherstone on the 23rd of November?
23rd of November, we're going to be in Featherstone
Library.
Details to follow.
So we'd love to see you there.
With an all-star celebrity panel.
For the World Cup.
All our friends, basically.
Yeah, the only people that are on our phone book.
We've had a look in the Rugby League Who's Who, and there's no one in there. They're all retired now. But we'll find some people, so details to follow on that. We'll be back at some point in the future. I know we'll be back in a couple of weeks, but we might be back before then, you never know. So thanks for watching. Download the podcast. Tell everyone you've been watching this programme, and we'll see you very soon.
Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.